That's where I really learned to use my voice and that I can petition my government. That's one of my rights.
I actually think it's a responsibility to do town hall meetings, but I am done. I will never do a town hall like that again.
You know, balancing the two sides, so to speak, of people who are supportive of the president and those who are mortified and horrified by his actions is the challenge.
Hey there, it's Julie, and this is Top of Mind. Americans are really angry right now about the state of things. We're mad at the other side. We're resentful of government institutions. 60% of us disapprove of the job Congress is doing. And all of this anger is showing up online, in the streets, and in the way we interact with our elected leaders. Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson even recommended that members of Congress stop holding in-person town hall meetings during the first few months of the second Trump administration.
The best thing that our members can do is communicate directly, frequently, consistently with their constituents, and there are other avenues to do it than just going in to try to give the other side sound bites. I mean, they're doing this for the cameras, we all know it, and I think it's wise not to play into it right now.
But that did not sit well with frustrated constituents who felt like the message was, if you can't say anything nice, you are not welcome. America is, after all, a representative democracy. So why do we, the people, feel so often like we're not being heard by our representatives in Washington? Is something broken, or is this just how the system's supposed to work? So that's what I've been wondering lately, as I've felt myself tempted to just tune it all out. But that is not an answer I'm comfortable with either, because for one thing, that just means I'm lucky enough to be insulated from the effects of decisions being made in Washington. Even more important for me, though, is the fact that my faith calls me to be actively engaged in making my community better and to look beyond my own self-interest. That's the whole point of Top of Mind, really. So today, we're going to talk through the frustration many citizens feel with two members of Congress, a Republican and a Democrat. We'll also get some historical insight and then some practical ideas from a citizen who's learned how to make herself heard. Did you know that the First Amendment guarantees the right to, quote, petition the government for a redress of our grievances? We always think about freedom of speech, assembly, and religion, but right alongside those is the constitutional right to make our case to representatives in Washington.
If you measure us by how frustrated people are, we're not doing well. Right? I think that's fair.
Republican John Curtis has been in Congress for 8 years, 7 of those representing Utah's 3rd district in the House of Representatives, and now he's in the U.S. Senate. Before Congress, he was the mayor of my hometown, Provo, Utah. Also, in full transparency, my brother-in-law has been one of Curtis's top aides for more than a decade. Senator Curtis is one of these politicians who's always leaned into the public interaction part of the job.
My team, we've always loved town hall meetings. We went through a period of time when we were doing 5 a week. When people say, like, how do you stay in tune? I don't know of a better way than somebody, like, literally 5 feet away from me, looking me in the eye and saying, I hate your bill, right? And so I mean, fundamentally, I get that these are very important.
But Senator Curtis says something shifted for him recently. It's why I called him up, actually, because I saw an op-ed that he wrote about how he was done doing traditional town halls.
You know, we were doing these, and this constant theme was coming up, which is that one or two or maybe 3 people were dominating the whole dialogue. And they wouldn't let go of an issue, no matter how I answered it. And you know, there were dozens, sometimes 50, sometimes 100 people had come and couldn't get their question in. So I just said, I'm going to reimagine town halls. And what I came up with was a format where I would give a little introduction, about roughly 20 minutes of, hey, here's what happens in Washington, here's what I'm working on. And then people could sign up for 5-minute meetings with me. And I committed to stay as long as it took to get through everybody who was also willing to wait for these 5-minute interviews. And sometimes we'd go 2 hours, 5 minutes at a time, and they could use their time to yell at me, to ask me questions, to, you know, inform me, anything they wanted to do. It was their 5 minutes. And I started asking, like, so how do you like the format? And guess who didn't like it? The 1 or 2 or 3 who got to showboat, and what they really wanted was to have, you know, this chance in front of other people to say, look how great I am. Let me see if I can embarrass him. And all the people who just had a legitimate question, I had some people, Julie, who would come and had never talked to a congressman. Hmm. And that's all they wanted. They simply wanted to talk to me and feel connected. That type of person is never going to raise their hand in a stereotypical town hall meeting. And I can't tell you that we've absolutely found like the end all, but I think mixing it up has been very healthy.
What do you miss, do you think, by doing it that way?
You miss people yelling at you and trying to embarrass you, because you know what? They don't yell at you when it's one-on-one.
Do you think you miss a little bit of the... I mean, it's a pretty good way to get a sense for like how worked up people are about something if you can sort of be in a room and see them. Or do you disagree?
Yeah, I would disagree, and I'll tell you why. I think a town hall meeting where two or three people are dominating is an echo chamber. And I think when I go through a couple of hours of 5-minute meetings, I get a slice. It's an important slice, but it is not an overall sense of how people feel.
Okay, so how do you know how people feel if town halls aren't the...
They're a piece of it.
Aren't the tool.
Right? You would be shocked how many people talk to me in the grocery store, the soccer field, right? I hear more good feedback on an airplane than I do in many town halls. And so all of those come together. I kind of have this, I call it my church echo chamber. Like if I hear in church something four times, then I know I better times that by about 4,000. You know, this last week, we drove close to 1,000 miles. I mean, with businesses, I was meeting with elected officials, and I put all those together, and it's this patchwork of this is how Utah feels. Individually, they might be echo chambers, but combined, they're really valuable sense of where people are at.
So what do you say then to the constituent who says, I've never been able to get one of these one-on-one slots, and I've called their office a couple of times, and I've sent some emails, and he clearly doesn't listen because he just went ahead and voted the way that I already knew he was going to vote anyway, and it's very frustrating to me. I mean, this is something that a lot of Americans feel.
So I would say, first of all, I would validate, like, I get that you feel that way, and I don't know that you're wrong. On the other hand, I am using every conceivable tool I can imagine to get to 3.5 million people. Hmm. Some weeks we get 15,000 emails that come in. And I promise you, I will run as hard and fast as I can to get to you, as many of you as I can. But at the end of the day, representative form of government means I may not vote the way you want me to vote, but you shouldn't assume that I'm doing that to kind of like in your face, right? Like, and the reality of it is, look, I represent Provo, Utah. I represent Park City. I represent Moab. I represent San Juan County.
Okay, let me just translate the point here. He's listing off parts of Utah that are really different. Provo is highly educated and conservative. Park City is wealthy and liberal. Moab is a tourist magnet. And San Juan County is rural farm and ranch land.
Is it at all possible I'm going to disappoint somebody, right, in those demographics in how I vote? And my job is to speak the best I can for all of those voices.
Have you changed your mind or taken an action that you hadn't planned on taking because of something you heard in an encounter with a constituent?
A lot. Often. A really interesting one I still take a lot of grief on was several years ago. We voted in Congress to give states more time to ratify the ERA.
The Equal Rights Amendment.
Equal Rights Amendment. I remember my mother lobbying against this. My automatic paradigm is, this is not good. And if you take the typical lines out there, this means, well, we're going to have problems with women's restrooms and men's restrooms. We're going to, and the abortion issue comes up. It gets very, very, like, political and very complicated. And remember, that's the paradigm of growing up in my home. My mother, a woman, right? And then, by the way, a very strong woman, out lobbying against this.
It was not uncommon in the 1960s and 70s
yes,
and 80s
yeah,
in
yeah.
Utah.
So, yeah, exactly. So my first blush is, no way, right? No way. And I had a women's council at the time. And one of the persons on that council, and I still remember where I was standing in the phone call, she said two things I think that impacted me in a really dramatic way. I said to her, well, what do we do about restrooms, right? What do we do about like all of these issues that I had been told this is brought up? And she said this, can we just agree women are equal and then solve all those problems? Well, that's a pretty compelling, like, how can I not, right? And then her second question was, have you read it? And so I had not. So I went home and I read it. And do you know what it says, the ERA amendment? It says women are equal.
So when the vote happened in 2021, Curtis was one of just four Republicans in the House to support extending the deadline to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment. It was not the way the majority of his very conservative Utah district wanted him to vote.
And it's I've taken probably more flack on that vote than I have any other vote. But I do think it shows you a really clear example of how literally one person had a really significant impact on the way that I viewed that. But like, if you go back to the early part of our conversations, I do think it's important for Americans to have appropriate expectations. A congressman represents about 700,000-800,000 people. Can you imagine being a senator in California? Like, I'm fortunate that I got 3.5 million. And of course, people are going to be frustrated. And I think I and my colleagues need to try harder to connect. And people need to on the other hand, do a better job, a continually better job of figuring out ways to connect. Look, let's be honest. If you put a comment at the end of a newspaper article that says I'm an idiot, you're not going to have much influence. Right. If you're referring to that as your influence, you're not going to have a lot. But if you find that cross section, whether it's a town hall meeting or it's an appropriate written letter, I'm just going to tell you those things do matter to us. And I think I speak hopefully for all of my colleagues that we desperately want that, and figuring out how to deal with the volume and make people feel represented is something that we should never say we've arrived.
That's Republican Senator John Curtis of Utah. His efforts to be responsive to his constituents have actually earned him a couple of democracy awards from the nonpartisan Congressional Management Foundation over the years. But the former head of that group jokes that the Meryl Streep of the democracy awards is Pennsylvania Democrat Chrissy Houlihan. She's the only member of Congress to win twice in the same year for transparency and service to constituents struggling with things like delayed tax returns and Social Security payments.
So somebody told me when I first started running for Congress that I would likely, first of all, not win. That was, you know, if you are interested in running, are you willing to run again once you lose for the first time? That was one of the first questions that I got.
That was 2018. Houlihan hasn't lost yet.
And then when they said and likely even if you win, you'll be in the minority and you'll likely be confined to what they called like customer service or constituent, you know, service. And are you okay with that? And I said, like, in addition to being a teacher, I also was a business person, an executive and an operator of a very large business. And part of my job was effectively operations and logistics and customer service. So I'm completely comfortable with that being my job. My job is to help people and my job is to make our system work better.
You maybe noticed a slight ringing in the background there. It was the signal to come back to the House floor and to vote, which is, of course, the other big part of Houlihan's job. But as a Democrat in the House minority, she doesn't have much say over what gets heard in committee or voted on. She can, however, control how much she listens to constituents. And she often hosts more town halls than anyone else in the Pennsylvania delegation, even as these meetings have become increasingly hostile.
I think what I try to do is take a lesson from my past. In the past, I was a teacher for a time, a high school chemistry teacher, and I learned a lot about a concept called classroom management. And effectively what that is trying to make sure that you level set for the norms in the room. You know, this is the way that we're going to talk to one another, and this is the way that we're going to act with one another. And we're going to all, in this case, assume that each one of us is a patriot. Each one of us loves our country. Each one of us loves our family. And we're going to proceed from there and be respectful.
So when you go into these town hall meetings, then do you actually start with like, here are the rules?
Yep. The other thing that we typically do with town hall meetings is most of the time we have a content or a topic that we're talking about or focused on one area or two, so that it isn't sort of just a free for all of everybody standing up and yelling at each other, which is what you sort of visualize now when you think about town halls. And rather I spend some time delivering some content, maybe even somebody from our community or from Washington that has some expertise. And at that point, then we open it up for questions and that sort of thing, because most likely, I hope, we've delivered what most people will already be interested in or concerned about or questioning. And also when we ask for questions, we try to make sure that they're not all the same exact questions over and over again, so that people have an opportunity to hear a diversity of opinions and a diversity of questions as well.
What would you say then, Representative, to constituents, members of the 6th Congressional District who feel like Congress doesn't listen? My voice is falling on deaf ears.
Yeah, I understand, because sometimes I feel like that too, and I'm here. What I would say is there really are still some very good people here in Washington who very much are listening. And please do keep calling your members of Congress and also your senators, your representative government. Please do keep abreast of news and challenge yourself to look for news in different places and different sources and not from the same place all the time. Challenge yourself to talk to people who you wouldn't normally talk to. I think that this democracy has withstood an awful lot. I still have very much hope in the next 250 years of our country, but it requires the citizens to be working. We are just sort of a reflection of the citizenry. And so we need you to have hope so that we can keep going for the next 250 years.
Representative Houlihan, thank you very much for your time today.
You're welcome. Talk to you later.
Democrat Chrissy Houlihan is Pennsylvania's 6th District Representative in the U.S. House. And she's a winner of multiple democracy awards from the nonpartisan Congressional Management Foundation. Okay, so now for a bit of useful history on influencing our members of Congress. What did the framers of the Constitution have in mind exactly when they guaranteed the right to petition the government for redress of grievances?
Petitions back then took a similar form, though they were on paper, you know, not through email or through a website. How they were used has changed a lot.
Starting with the fact that petitions drove most of what Congress debated and passed. Can you imagine getting that kind of attention from your representative today? Well, that's next here on Top of Mind from the BYU Radio Podcast Network. I'm Julie Rose. Hey, friends, if you are looking for another great show from the BYU Radio family of podcasts, check out Constant Wonder. Host Marcus Smith takes you on an exhilarating journey through captivating stories of our magnificent natural world. You'll gain profound insight into different facets of our planet, discover more about nature, and maybe even ponder your connection to Earth's wonder. The show is Constant Wonder, and you can find it wherever you get your podcasts. If you were going to start a petition, what would it be about? I personally would love to have Congress require more legroom on airplanes, please. But what's the point, really? Petitions these days rarely bring any kind of change. Historically, though, Congress paid close attention.
You might not get what you wanted, but you would at least get a response.
This is Ben Schneer.
I'm an assistant professor of public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School.
He studies American politics.
Part of that is also some work I've done studying the use of petitions.
Schneer was on a team that built a database of every petition submitted to the United States Congress from the founding until the mid-1900s, when the practice of petitioning the government petered out. There are more than 500,000 petitions in that database, and Schneer says the act of writing down a demand and collecting signatures had, for centuries leading up to the American Revolution, been the way to get your concerns heard by the people in power. So the framers of the Constitution were eager to preserve it.
In England, there had been sort of efforts by the monarchy to actually silence petitioning, the Act Against Tumultuous Petitioning, I think it was called. And then later on, the House of Commons had said, well, we're not going to look at any petitions about new taxes by the Crown. So this sort of petitions being cut off or banned was surely on their minds.
And the act of petitioning at the time came with the expectation of serious consideration by the powerful, says Schneer. Each petition was carefully cataloged in the congressional record and given an official response.
I mean, in the early Congresses, they would spend days sometimes debating an issue that was raised by a single petition or petitions. And members of Congress would complain about how much time, you know, that Congress wasn't meeting for that long. And so they would complain about how much time this was taking.
Were they actually passing legislation as a result of these petitions?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And many bills that were introduced actually were derived from specific petition requests. So absolutely.
What were some of the things that came up a lot?
So there's a really wide variety of things. There are people petitioning, women petitioning for suffrage, anti-slavery petitions. Sabbatarianism was a big issue. Should things be closed on Sunday or not? Lots of petitions, interestingly enough, about like the World's Fair. You know, should people be able to go to the World's Fair on Sunday or not?
Were petitions ever personal?
The answer is, on some issues, yes. Probably the biggest one had to do with Civil War pensions. Say your husband fought in a war and then passed away, petitioning to continue to receive that pension.
Was anyone eligible to send a petition? Did you have to be of a certain social status or be a voter?
No. So in contrast to being able to vote, where at this time, you know, it's mostly white men who were able to vote, anyone could send a petition. And so petitions were a tool used by otherwise disenfranchised groups, including women, African-Americans, indigenous people. These are all groups that made use of the petition precisely because that was a way to get some response from the government. There are many really interesting, notable examples where there are huge petitioning campaigns coordinated by women. One of the first ones of these was anti-slavery petitioning. And so there are these accounts of women talking about walking 5, 10, 15 miles a day seeking signatures.
Do we have any sense as to how often petitions were successful?
In terms of getting things onto the agenda of Congress, I think very successful. In terms of on a case-by-case basis, did this petition cause Congress to do something differently than they would have on its own? Very rare is the way I would think of it. However, another way to think about petitioning and a really important role that petitioning played was actually forming bonds between the petitioners themselves. And so you can think of the petition as almost an organizational tool, right? If you're trying to form a group around a particular issue, knowing who's willing to sign your petition, knowing who's willing to canvass a petition is valuable information if you're trying to organize politically.
And we can see that playing out today. I mean, that's maybe even more the role that petitions play.
Absolutely. I mean, I would say the role, as far as I understand it, because you don't necessarily expect any response at all, the role of petitioning is almost entirely about the connections between people and identifying who supports something.
Ben Schneer says petitioning Congress in the formal way that the founders envisioned came in waves through the 1800s, spiking around big issues like slavery or labor reform. By the end of World War I, the practice began a steady decline. Part of that was just practical, says Schneer. A whole government bureaucracy was coming online to deal with stuff that individuals might have petitioned Congress for in the past, like veterans benefits.
Then also, I think there's the growth of a lobbying apparatus, and there's sort of more institutionalized process with lobbying firms and specific channels and even rules around lobbying. It's just a different world in terms of how you would engage with a member of Congress. And petitioning just doesn't seem to fit into that in the same way.
And we have more direct ways of airing our grievances. We can email or call our members of Congress with just a few clicks. But Schneer thinks those fall short of the original purpose and power of the right to petition.
An individual phone call or a letter, it's not public, really, in the same way, I think, that the petition was. And there's not the same sort of group element to it. And then another important difference with as everything has moved online is it's essentially costless to contact. You know, you're literally just clicking a button. So whereas you might have thought that in the 1830s, women walking 15 miles a day to gather signatures, that's like a really costly signal of how much they care about an issue. It's easier to dismiss an e-petition.
Yeah, so what have we lost?
One of the main things that's maybe been lost is this norm of a response. there's not necessarily the same sense in which this is like a real legitimate pressure valve for when people are feeling like really, really strongly about an issue and feel like they have nowhere else to go. It used to be, well, we'll send a petition and at least we'll get a response. It's not clear to me like what exactly fills that role now. I mean, people are, you know, very creative and innovative and are always finding ways to channel what their grievances are to their elected representatives. And the town halls we've seen are one example. And another version of that could just be tweeting at your representative. But the ways in which you express your grievances are maybe not as productive and as sort of generative as canvassing a petition.
Ben Schneer is a professor of public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. So we've lost the norm of investing a lot of energy to air our grievances, and there's no longer the expectation of a thoughtful response from Congress. But in one sense, the spirit of making a plea to Congress and getting a response is alive and well in the form of constituent services.
Every office has what's called either a caseworker or customer service, constituent service representative, who helps constituents liaison with federal agencies or really do anything.
Bradford Fitch is a former congressional staffer, and until recently, he was head of the Congressional Management Foundation, which gives out those democracy awards for constituent service.
I mean, it's everything from someone lost their Social Security check and they need help navigating it to get back to my grandfather was in the Korean War. He's dying and he lost all of his medals. Can you get replacements from the Department of Defense? My favorite story happened during the pandemic when a woman in April of 2020 was at her wit's end. She contacted her congressman's office and said, I can't find toilet paper. And this was obviously a hard thing to do in April of 2020. A lot of us couldn't find toilet paper. She was 8 months pregnant. She had a two-year-old baby. When she came home from the hospital, there was a carton of toilet paper waiting there, courtesy of her congressional office. And she wrote a letter back to the congresswoman, profusely thanking her for going out of her way. But the one line that really caught me that I just was amazed at, she said, thank you for seeing me. Hmm. And yeah, that act sounds weird, the getting her toilet paper in a time of need. But part of what the constituent service representatives do is by being responsive and trying to help out these constituents, they're demonstrating government work. They're demonstrating that their voice can be heard and that there are people out there really going to bat for them when needed.
Interestingly, Fitch says this customer service piece of congressional work is a relatively recent addition to the job description.
Starting in the 1960s, when the Congress grew its individual offices from about 6 to 7 staff members in the House to now there's a cap on 18 full-time staff members, they then added constituent services to this job listing.
Why is it that Congress decided to take on this responsibility if it's not technically something that they had been doing?
Well, a political scientist explained this to me once, and it's pretty funny. It's because in 1964, the Republicans got shellacked in the elections. In 1966, the Democrats got shellacked, and the only thing they could collectively agree on, let's increase our staff size and provide better services to constituents so we don't get clobbered. I mean, so originally it was a political incentive. But the reality is these kinds of services don't serve many constituents. Sometimes they're used in political ads, but most of these success stories just frankly go unnoticed except by the people who are profoundly impacted by it.
Now, as for influencing how members of Congress vote, Fitch says the first thing to understand is that on some issues, your calls and emails probably won't make a difference.
There is this category I call electoral and reputational issues. It's really hard to change a member of Congress's position on guns, immigration, and abortion. If you're a Republican and in a very Republican district and you support gun safety legislation, you'll probably be facing a primary. That's an electoral issue. Sometimes I called this when I was working in the Senate, I called them eulogy issues. You know, Senator, this is something they're going to talk about at your eulogy. So think about this vote. That's 3% of what the Congress works on. The rest is all these other minor issues, whether or not horses are transported on double-decker trucks, whether or not optometrists can use lasers at VA hospitals on veterans, which the ophthalmologists really don't want to happen. And so you got the optometrists versus the ophthalmologists going at it. And so the member of Congress is trying to figure out, well, you know, who's right?
They and so listen. If I have a dog in that fight, then my voice might also be useful.
Absolutely. I'll give you, there are two types of people that talk to Congress, people with an interest and people with an opinion. A few years ago, if a woman came to a town hall meeting and said, I think we ought to get out of Afghanistan, the Congresswoman would file it in one part of her brain. If another woman got up at the same meeting and said, I think we ought to get out of Afghanistan because my daughter is stationed in Kabul in the army, that's a different part of the brain. The member of Congress treats that different person different. They've got skin in the game, and they take that much more seriously. I'm not saying they dismiss the other one with an opinion, but you know, I asked one staffer, what does a member of Congress use to make decisions? And he said they use the three H's, head, heart, and health, meaning political health. So head, they like to study issues, they're policy wonks. They want nothing more to study an issue, come up with a solution, and impose it on the rest of us. They heart, emotion, personal stories can change a member's opinion. And then political health. You know, if this is a case of transportation workers versus oil industry workers, yeah, I'm going to weigh a little bit on which those industries are in my state and which one's bigger. And the personal stories usually indicates to them this is a person who's representative of others that are affected by this.
Bradford Fitch is the former longtime CEO of the Congressional Management Foundation, which is a leading nonprofit helping members of Congress improve their interactions with constituents. He's also got a book that I highly recommend for beginners looking to get more involved in the civic process. It's called The Citizen's Handbook to Influencing Elected Officials. An updated version is coming out soon. Next, how a young mom with no political savvy found her voice in Iowa.
I do my research. Which committees are they on? What have they currently co-sponsored? What's going on in their political lives?
And then what? That's coming up next on Top of Mind from the BYU Radio Podcast Network. It's great to have you with us. I'm Julie Rose. Okay, Top of Mind listeners, before we get right back to today's episode, I would like to introduce you to another gem of a show from the BYU Radio family of podcasts. It's In Good Faith. It's hosted by Stephen Cap Perry. And on each episode, he interviews members of different religions and spiritualities to better understand their relationship with the divine. Whether you wish to strengthen your own relationship or just listen to thoughtful conversations about religion, dive into an enriching world of spiritual exploration with Stephen Cap Perry on In Good Faith. Listen anywhere you get podcasts.
My name is Tiffany Welch. I currently live in Clive, Iowa. I am a mom of two. I am an advocate. I am a citizen, and I work part-time in retail.
She can point to a specific moment when she decided to add advocate to that list. It was a mid-afternoon.
This is the fall of 2015. My youngest has just started into pre-K, so I had a little bit more blocks of time to do something. And a canvasser for this organization,
Save the Children Action Network,
knocked on my door that they were looking for people to advocate around early childhood education, which is definitely something that's very important to me. My degree is in human development. This turned into a great way to use that part of my brain.
She signed on as a volunteer, and before long, she was helping recruit and mobilize other moms like her.
One of my first actions that I took was to go to a candidate event. Martin O'Malley was getting ready to run for president, and to ask him a question. What would he do when he was president to extend access to childcare and quality preschool education? And I was incredibly nervous. And I had rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed exactly what I wanted to say. He finally called on me. I asked my question. He gave an okay answer. And then, you know, I was able to worm my way up and get a photo with him and follow up a little bit on what I had hoped to hear. And then I noticed that at some of his campaign events later months, that he had tweaked his answer a little bit. And that's another point where it clicked that, hey, they often listen.
In the 10 years since that town hall, Welch has honed a toolbox of strategies to influence her elected officials.
Anytime I have something that I want to reach out about, I do my research. Which committees are they on? What have they currently co-sponsored? What's going on in their political lives? I follow all of them on the various social medias. I subscribe to their email letters. Like if I see events that are coming up, my Senator Grassley, every year he goes to all 99 counties in Iowa and has events. But a lot of the ones in the more populous counties are often private events. So I have learned, along with other advocates, that if I am able to make it to drive up to an hour to some of the smaller counties, that's where I can have even more influence because there are fewer people and he's holding events that are more open. Being part of an organized group is a group that is not hostile, that we don't do gotcha questions. We have honest questions, we have data to back up, and that's something else that I found about other issues when I'm interacting with people, is to make sure that not being hostile often goes a long way.
did you learn that the hard way? Have you had experiences feeling like you just really needed to show up and kind of vent on somebody?
Wanting to, yes, and that's very different from actually doing it. I keep notes on my phone, honestly, of like my grievances. The times when it's really, when I'm really frustrated, there's actually with Senator Grassley, where I was asking him questions about a nutrition program in the Farm Bill in 2018, the answer that he gave me about this at a town hall was completely dismiss the topic, you know, well, I think the kids are fine. Like just kind of a crusty, again, like not, it didn't track with other interactions that I've had with him. It was so frustrating. And I wrote a very passionate yet professional letter to the editor. And I know that their staff, they look for the op-eds, they look for letters to the editor. And the next time that one of our volunteers interacted with him, it was a much softer tone from him. So that was, it's always interesting, again, like correlation, causation, who knows, but there are always ways to have interactions that are more likely to have in that long game a better effect than just like screaming and yelling. But I can't, I certainly get the frustration and I don't blame anybody for going that route.
What has surprised you in 10 years now that you've been doing this? Like what has surprised you about what works and what doesn't work?
The most surprising thing is how much staffers, do not ever discount the staffers. There's one of the big things with Senator Ernst, there was a rural childhood, the Expanding Rural Child Care Act that we were trying to get her involved in. And she was just not really responding to anything until we had one advocate that was able to make a connection with one of her staffers. And like 2 days later, she's like, okay, I'm a co-sponsor, I'm on this. It was that connection from a meeting with a staffer that he was then able to influence her. So don't ever be disappointed when you're talking to just staffers. There's no such thing as just a staffer.
And speaking of surprises, there's a story that Welch thinks about often and she was eager to share. It happened to a close friend of hers on Christmas Eve one year.
So she's Jewish, she owns a business, and she was really frustrated with our representative with some of the votes that he was taking in 2017. So she called, she frequently calls and leaves messages, emails. She called on Christmas Eve, his local, you know, in-district office, expecting to leave another voicemail, but he answered the phone. He's a very chatty guy and asked if she could come over to his office. And so she came on down and they talked for, I believe it was an hour and a half. His votes didn't change, but the fact that he took that time on a holiday away from his family is quite honestly unheard of. It was rare back then. I think it's, depending on the representative, I feel like it'd be even more rare today.
Why do you think it would be less likely today?
I think that people are just so ingrained in I'm right, you're wrong. There's so many moral issues that are being debated that it's just so hard to reach out and have conversations and keep them civil. If anything, it made me more passionate about approaching elected officials because it shows that it is possible to have interactions and respect each other, even if nobody's mind has changed, but to hear each other out.
Tiffany, thanks so much for sharing your stories with us.
Yes,
today.
Thank you for having me.
Tiffany Welch is a volunteer advocate with the Save the Children Action Network. I keep thinking about the contrast between what it originally meant to petition for a redress of grievances and the options that are available to us today. Ben Schneer at Harvard says he thinks petitions were productive and generative. I like both of those words. Because petitions took some effort on the part of the people, and people could expect a response from Congress. We've heard lots of ideas today on how to get heard by our elected leaders, but I wonder what the more effortful approach might be that could generate a more productive outcome. Would it be a personalized email written from scratch rather than auto-generated? Or a handwritten letter, maybe, with pen and actual paper? I've seen stories recently of women who are stitching their messages into handmade quilts for members of Congress. And how could we restore the norm of a response from our elected officials? The automated form letter just doesn't seem to cut it. But what else is realistic when senators and members of Congress have hundreds of thousands, even millions of people to hear and represent? Well, I'd love to hear your thoughts. What could your representatives do to satisfy your need to be heard? Are you even trying to be heard? Or maybe voting is how you're using your voice. Send an email to topofmind@byu.edu and let's continue this conversation. Top of Mind is a BYU Radio podcast. Today's episode was produced by Caleb Leach, Abby Karras, and me, with help from Taya Wolf, Isabella Sosa, Samuel Benson, and Sam Payne. Our audio engineer is Lauren Sandberg. I'm Julie Rose. We'll talk soon.